notion of I, we, and where you use it, and when you mean it, and when you feel it, and they're not always the same. And I think an awful lot of loss is associated with a we. Is that you know it's, you know, if you've heartbreak, you're no longer we, you're me again.
Welcome to the Social Fabric podcast with me, Andrea Splendori, and this week my guest is Michael Fitzgerald. Michael is a businessman with a bigger heart and a creative way of raising funds and awareness for his community social responsibility arm of the business. The music in this podcast has been shortened for rights reason. The show is also broadcast weekly on Near FM 90.3. Please subscribe, share, and review. It's the only way podcasts like this have a chance to survive. The title tune is Alice by Lucky Bones.
Can I call you up, oh Alice, on a Friday night? We could reminisce on old days, and we could talk a while. Just sit and talk a while.
Where are you based, actually, Michael?
I'm based in Cork City.
I thought, I was looking at your website. I recognize most of it. Nice photo. Yeah, yeah. Lovely.
Yeah, I was born in Limerick, moved to Cork when I was quite young, then moved away in my mid-20s, and I suppose I always had an understanding what it was to be like, to be an exile in a place, because even moving to Cork at a young age, I was always reminded I'd come to Cork. I wasn't of it, and I also saw that as a disadvantage, but then I thought over time, when I emigrated in the 80s to the UK, and same as probably having a second language, you have a second view, and you can step back, and then you see patterns, and you see commonality, and you see differences, as opposed to, you know, you understand what, you know, you understand your tribe better, I think. If you don't start in one spot and stay there all the time, and I used to love Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, and the notion of doubt, that when you try and measure something, it changes. You can either know its position or thing, and politically, I'd be a devil's advocate. because I always like to tease an idea out, and I think I don't know how I got to here, but that bit of always feeling a little bit of an exile or a floater, it kind of informs a lot of my sensibility.
That's interesting. Well, I guess that's where we start then, because you say something there that really caught my ear, because I'm an exile from Rome, and I have a second language, and I know exactly what you're talking about in terms of having that different perspective when you interpret something from, you know, sometimes you have to translate it. But for you, you went from Limerick to Cork, which is, it's not that much of a stretch from me coming from Rome, but at the same time, no. I've been here 30 years, and I know there is a stretch between Limerick and Cork. So tell me about just tell me a bit more about that, because it's quite interesting.
It was just that bit where people, I have a big thing that everybody, you have an I and you have a we. And people underestimate how important being able to say we is, that you belong to something. And I just remember in school people saying, like, well, you'd be from Limerick, right? So that meant, and that wasn't giving you a tribe, it was actually excluding you. It was putting you outside the camp. And that bit with the language, I think, is that I'm a mathematician by training. And the great thing about language is that it's not mathematical. Words don't, they have a usage, but if you know a word in a second, if you know that meaning in a different language, it has a different nuance. And that nuance just gives you a different lens to look at things. You know, a word is much more fluid then, and because it becomes fluid, it's got such possibilities. And I think that's one of the places you can learn compassion is from that fluidity, that there isn't black and white. There's so much under everything, and therefore you can keep asking questions. And I think what keeps people young is curiosity. But I've always had this fascination with the notion of I, we, and where you use it, and when you mean it, and when you feel it, and they're not always the same. Mm. And I think an awful lot of loss is associated with a we. Is that if you've heartbreak, you're no longer we, you're me again, and that's great. That can be very good. But similarly with grief, the I stays continuous, and it takes a while to realize that the we stays continuous as well. You think the we has been broken, but it doesn't, because people live on, and they grow even though they're not there. They grow, and because your relationship changes, because as you change, your relationship with them changes. I'm in a mental health advocate, and an awful lot of loss of self that people feel with mental illness, but also if you I've worked with groups of people in the Irish Direct Provision Center system, and that bit about depression and loneliness and being separated or being tribalized, it's all a loss of connection. And learning how to include people as how to exclude people. Like discrimination is a natural thing in terms of to discriminate in the real sense of to know, to understand differences, right? But in understanding differences, the bit that's left over mathematically is commonality, right? So you're different from me in this way, but you're, right? And so discrimination on its own is okay, but if you discriminate against, it's the adding of against with that makes it a negative thing. And so I'd say be discriminating, yeah. Understand the differences and understand the commonality, because that's what that's what the word really is about. And I found it took me a long time to learn it. I found that the biggest thing you can do is make little bridges, you know. There's a beautiful song called "Make," where somebody's describing somebody else as being a maker of islands. And if we can make little islands for people, and you know, then the bridges can be smaller. You know,
nice picture, lovely picture. You know? Well, okay, that's a nice little introduction. I know you just mentioned the song. Just let's go straight into your first song, then, Michael.
What I've done, if you don't mind, is I've picked songs from our latest project, but they're all non-original songs, and the reason the project No Simple Highway is I've gone to a bunch of young musicians with a collection of songs that for me resonate with around the subjects of loss and grief and enduring love. And so the first song I've picked is a song called Thought Dream, which was originally on a 1967 album by Country Joe and the Fish. And the album is a psychedelic classic. But what's interesting is that this Thought Dream is surrounded on the album, and the actual track, the original track, has a psychedelic joke at the start and end of the song. And in the middle of these two, of them really hamming it up, you know, with a song called Please Don't Drop the H-Bomb on Me, right? Is this tender, tender ballad, right? Tender, tender, but it's actually a poem. It's a poem, and in the psychedelia of the day, they're playing around the poem. You know, the music is just playing around it. It's a layer on top of it. And I always thought it was a beautiful poem, but I thought that I wondered whether it was too personal to have on its own. And so I handed it to Anna Mitchell, who's part of the project. And I said, I think there's a beautiful song in here, right? Ignore the joke. And I said, find something beautiful in here. And she went and did that. They did that, and then they played it back to me at the first recording session. And I had at that stage gathered the whole. I had my entire narrative of songs that I was giving to people. I had my entire narrative of songs. And I sat down in the recording studio, and when I heard the lyrics, and when I heard it where somebody had gone in and pulled out the beauty, I realized that that song covered the entire project, because it talks about being able to, about the poet or the singer walking from summer into autumn. It's just summer into winter, right? In a split second. And he then says, I realized that the pains of old wounds caused me to mend them. And basically he's called to live in the present because it's not over. Right. And it's the nature of pain and grief. It doesn't end. It's the nature of everything you do. Everything you do is a work in progress until you're no longer around. And while I'd always loved the song, I'd always heard the song, and I always liked the song, and I loved the psychedelic element. And then it was stripped out, and this was presented to me. And it was, what I realized was, I was hearing what I'd always heard, but because it had been filtered through somebody else. So I just literally sat in the studio and tears ran down my face, right? And we're listening back. It's only the guide track. Tears are rolling down my face. And the band, who've only just met me, and Anna saying, you know, is it okay? And I said, you have no idea. I said, I have known that song for 40 years, and you've just decoded it for me. And a year and a half later, I heard Anna doing an interview on Canadian radio. And she said, what did you like about the project? She said, well, there's this song, Thought Dream. And she said, it's my absolutely favorite song. It's just such a beautiful song. And I was thinking, she's traveled the 18 months with it, and it's become, you know, it's seeped into her. And I think that's something that art can do. You can come up with words, you can try and persuade something, but you won't move somebody's position. But art can actually move the person, move their perspective, move it. And that's why, you know, the project is about the whole Sunrise, Some Fall project that we set up is about the fact that music and art can transform. It has a power to transform. And I remember reading Glyn Johns, the producer, who did a lot of an awful lot of famous albums in the 70s. And he described in his autobiography watching this enormous, overweight, awkward man coming up to play the church organ. And he was the young boy soloist, boy soprano. And when the music started, he watched this awkward body transform into a ballet as he moved the organ. And I remember the line where he said, basically, art transforms the performer as well as the listener. And music can transform and I've seen this with the project, which has been very interesting, is that I sold an idea, because whenever you're trying to convince somebody to do a project, you are selling. Mm-hmm. Right? And I sold the idea, and they, given that they were all songwriters, they were coming back to me and say, oh, what do you want? It's a cover. What do you want me to do? And I said, create some beauty, find some beauty in there, your own beauty. And they said, and will I run it by you? I said, no, go to the recording studio. I'll sit in on the recordings where I'm allowed, but find your own beauty in it. It was amazing what they did. What was wonderful for me is, that sounds great, but I have my idea of beauty. I suppose that Jerry Garcia, the Grateful Dead, always said, intelligence loves to be surprised. Now a lot of ego doesn't, but intelligence does. What I set out to do, they achieved, but it was very different. What it looked like and what it sounded like was not what I had designed. And the fact that I gave them the freedom meant that I have now all this new music created out of songs that I thought I knew. And so for me, I've been listening, I've been listening to this with the same excitement as when I first, I got my first LP and took out and carefully placed it on placed it on the record player. And yet I would have initiated the project, apart from one of the songs, I would have picked every one of the songs and done. But it's just as thrilling to me at the end, because they went on a journey with it. All I did was I handed them a box of paints, but what they came back with was very different. And at the same time, what we did was we also got a graphic artist to paint what was effectively the posters for the singles and the albums. But what she actually did is she made genuine paintings, which we then adapted, to make them. So she went off and she found her beauty, and again, with complete freedom. And separately, then we had a young videographer, and we said, here's some of the songs, find something that resonates. And she was saying, is there a storyboard and anything? No, I said, it's yours. And I've never seen the videos until the day we've released them, because I've said, look, the only thing I've got creative control on the videos is the credits. The rest is yours. Having a young person hear a song that's maybe 40 years old or something like that, and then coming back with a video that's pertinent to them, it's very revealing and rewarding.
Amazing. It just reminds me, there was an amazing documentary by based on the tape on the basement tapes by Bob Dylan, and there was T-Bone Burnett, that had a few, including Elvis Costello and a few people, sat down there with scraps of paper, and they had to rewrite the songs of Bob Dylan, and very much the same process. They got whatever their interpretation of it. But tell me a little bit more about this, Michael, this project. Why did you start, and what is it meant to be doing, and what is doing, and what did you set out to be?
Well, basically, as part, I run a consulting company, and as part of the consulting company, I have a piece within the company which will never generate revenue, only generates costs, right? But its currency that we measure it is in connection. It's called community support resources. And what happened was we produced the first album, which started off as, we produced an album back in, the process started back in about 2007, but illness and death and various other things got, and life got in the way. And it came to fruition in 2017. And I had worked with a bunch of different musicians on that project. But as we were, as I brought that to a sort of a focus, I said, okay, it's nice to have the music. It's nice to have the music, but there's a coherence to it in terms of what I was trying to do. I was trying to catch the human condition. And I said, well, it's no use catching it without trying to improve it for some people. So we got together with the charity Shine, which used to be Schizophrenia Ireland. And there was a couple of themes, a couple of songs running through that album that had the notion of shining on, to keep on shining. It'll Shine When It Shines, and I'll Take a Melody, which is basically is a song which is cognitive behavioral therapy in a song, if you like. It's just the notion of I'll take a simple C to G and feel brand new about it. That's cognitive behavioral therapy, right? And but we worked with Shine, and we went along to them and said, look, we're going to release this. We don't want to make any money. We're not, you know, because we don't have a thing. But do you want us to help you become, your services become better known? We'll release it. We'll donate money, right? But we don't need to sell any. We don't need to sell any amount of things to make the donation. You're getting the donation anyway. But is there a positive way we could work with you? So we did that, and we then got involved with Better Together, which was a group working with women and children in direct provision, and they were doing a creative project, a quilting project inside in one of the direct provision centers. And we were saying, well, look, that's artistic. Why don't you, you know, at the end of any artistic thing, you hope to have an exhibition. And they said, but how would we do it? And I said, we'll build those bridges. You just do what you're doing. And we got we went to the Cork City Libraries, and we said, look, there's this wonderful project going on. We see libraries as core to community because they're the one absolutely egalitarian structure. And you connect people with possibilities, which is, you know, through books and music. And there's this disconnected group, and they, as it happened, you know, we were pushing an open door because the libraries wanted a way to provide their services to the centres. So we said, why don't we launch it in the city library? We'll have a formal launch, and we launch it in the city library. And it was, and that came to pass. And it was one of those bits where your ego gets it so wrong. We were sitting there, and they were. We got the Lord Mayor to come in and launch it, and the various women were talking about their experience coming to Ireland and how positive this particular experience had been alongside the very negative experience in direct provision. And I was there, and there was a photographer, a guy with a camera beside me. I said, "Take a photograph. This captures exactly what we're trying to achieve." Right. In my ego, he took the photograph, and we have that photograph, but the photograph absolutely catches and 100% misses the big achievement, because at the very moment he took the photograph, right, which he then sent on, right, the children of the women in direct provision were running around me saying, they've just told us we can have any book we want and it's free. So from and what had happened is the library took the occasion to sign up all the children to the library, right? So I was there with my ego saying, oh, look what we've achieved. And I was missing it because what had actually happened was the serendipity of the, it had connected the children. And what we found afterwards is because the children were signed up, it meant the mobile library could now visit the various direct provision centers. So we pushed open a door, but not the door we thought we were pushing open. And so, but sorry, so that was, but when we finished the music album at that stage, we said we'd concentrate on that, those, that's, that social element. And we've worked with various groups like the, and we set up a thing with the library called the Conversation Cafe, which is a facilitated open to everybody conversation. So between ourselves and the library, we brought in a group called Think Speak Do Community. They facilitate the meetings and basically whoever wants to can wander in, sit down, there's coffee, tea, sit around various tables. There's a short talk from somebody. And then there's a facilitated conversation. People move around, they meet other people and they talk for an hour. It was, again, it was another case where we thought this would be mainly for people who were immigrants. But and we did the advertising to say, please, if you're new to the city or whatever, come in. But in fact, there were people who hadn't spoken to anybody in the entire weekend or for an entire week came in, and suddenly they had a conversation. And what was again, I was saying to the person who was working with me, set it up. We've got to come up with our measure of connection, right? And it can't be just the number of bodies. It can't be that, we've got 25 people. And so I said, let's keep our eyes open and let's see if we can get what the measure is here, because we don't know the currency yet. And we were there and she was there and she said, I said, how did it go? How did today's session go? And she said, it went well. And she said, it was nice. There was a couple of new attendees, and one person was a postgraduate student from Jordan who had just arrived, and she knew nobody. And she saw it. She went on to meetup.org and saw this, and so she came along, and she said it's funny. At the end of it, she went off for a cup of coffee with this 70-year-old woman from Cork because they'd hit it off. And I said, that's it.
That's the measure.
That's our measure. I said, brilliant. If you have two total strangers who go for a cup of coffee because they found commonality, that's the measure. Brilliant. And that's kept running. It stopped during, like everything else, everything came to a shuddering halt during lockdown. But it started again last month on Zoom. And one of the bits I was worried was that, what about the older people who used to attend? But the first one was last month, and one of my ex-colleagues was online, and she said, it's amazing when people are connected, how they connect. They automatically connect, and a lot of the older faces were back. And there's another one now. There's one on this coming Thursday, and again, it's free to anybody who logs in, and it's called Anew, which is about we're going to be the old world has changed, but we have to learn how to to start again. And start again doesn't mean start where you finished. It may mean what does a new mean to people. And it's so it'll be interesting to see what will come out of that discussion.
strange.
But
so tell me about the second song, Michael, before I ask you something else that I
yeah, the second song is a song called I Remember You, which it's by a singer-songwriter from Idaho, Island Jewel, who defies description, because she could be rockabilly one moment, she can be Billie Holiday another moment, but her songs are beautiful. But this particular one, I Remember You, is somebody meeting up. For me, it evokes somebody meeting up with somebody who was once very dear to them, and that the person they meet up with has been through a lot, and doesn't believe they're even remembered. You know, it's that bit of, there are some people in your life that you see and who see you. Now, you might only meet them for a minute, right? You might only meet them for a day, but they matter. They matter that day, they matter forever. This song very much catches that bit of, I remember you. There's a beautiful line in it, which is, I let you shoot my hats off because I knew you'd never miss. Alongside a sort of what sounds like a throwaway line is, you know, you were in a padded room. I tried to give you cigarettes. You told me leave me alone, but I remember you. You stand out from the rest. And, you know, I've reached the age of my life and been through a lot where when I heard that song first, you know, a handful of people came back and I thought, I should reconnect with these people because they still matter. And it's that bit of connection again. You've lost part of yourself if you don't connect. Again, it was one of those songs where I sent it across to John Bleck, who sings it on the album. John had never heard the song, and it was in a bunch, including a number of songs which I really thought were designed for him. But I gave him some of the rest. I gave him all the songs. And he said, within 5 minutes he was back and said, has anybody recorded that song? Has anybody put their hand up for that song? And I said, no. He said, it's mine. He stripped all the layers and it's just, I remember you. The song was written possibly six years ago. But when John sings it, it could have been written 50 years ago, 60 years ago, because it's just the very simple guitar and banjo. So, you know, it could have been, it could have come from the folk revival. It could have come, it's timeless. And I think that's the bit when you, with something that has a fundamental resonation, is that it should resonate at any time. The John Bleck's recording of I Remember You is the bookend to It's Not Over, because a lot of the songs are about parting, and this last song is a parting and loss. And this last song is saying, you know, if you go through all this life, there are still people who you remember. You have your tribe, you have your chosen family. You get, you know, you do get to choose your family in life. I just think that it's, even though there's some dark images in the song, it's a very, very positive thing.
I remember you. You were full of broken bones. I offered you a cigarette. You said, leave me alone. Yeah, I remember you. Locked up in your padded room. I tried to teach you solid air. You just hollered at the moon. But I remember you. Yeah, I remember you.
Hey, tell me something then, Michael, about the project itself. So it's called Some Rise, Some Fall, and it's predominantly loss, grief, and enduring love, as you said at the beginning.
Yeah.
And obviously, you mentioned a few times about connections and choosing your family, and I'm all for that. That's why I do this podcast. That's exactly why, yeah, I do it. I want to connect people for the right reason. Somebody listening to you, perhaps something resonates with them, and who knows what's going to happen. You know, you might contact John Blake. Could be anything. Could be absolutely anything. That's really having that open mind and allowing the different colors and the different flavors and the different sounds in our lives. But with this particular project, I just want to, like, the people got involved, and you came across through Brian Hassett of In Bloom Agency. So I do the other show that I do. It's just a music program, and that's how Brian came across me. But the guys that are working with you on this project, all these young, these Irish artists, what's their involvement in, apart from recording? How did you get, how did you sell the idea, for put it like that? You come along?
Well, basically, I sold it, but there were two elements to it. One, I think these are beautiful songs, and there's an opportunity. If you're a professional musician, right? To a certain extent, you have to produce. Somebody gets to judge the music at the end. They either turn up or they don't turn up, and that's usually not why you started. You started because you loved music and you needed to perform. You needed to be creative, and with this one, I was saying, look, you've got total control over it. It's going to come out under the Sunrise, Sunfall banner. I'll fund it. Every penny raised from it, every sale will go to a charity that is going to connect people. But all the expenses, my company would pick up, because what I want you to do is I don't want you to send me back something until you're happy with it. A few people would have turned it down. A few people who I thought might have done, a few people turned it down. But for example, Brian Hassett plays bass on all the tracks with Anna Mitchell. Now, I knew Anna in that I'd gone to a few of her gigs, and I knew Brian Hassett because when we did our first project, the Some Climb project, as opposed to No Simple Highway project, we had performed in Collins, which is a venue that he runs. And I got introduced to him, and then we discovered that we're cousins, but we're 30 years apart, 25 years apart. So when I immigrated, I immigrated when he was three. So we never met until we met in a musical situation. So I went to see Anna perform, and I had songs in my head, right? Because you always do. I had songs in my head and said, "Oh, she could really. She has the voice that allows that part to be done." But I didn't know her well. I had seen her at gigs. Through a mutual friend, I got her email, and I sent her an email. And said, "Look, we've been talking and stuff like that. I've had this idea. Here's what it's about." And if you like, I vomited on the page about the idea. Here's the history of what we've been doing. Here's what I'd like to do. This is a much more focused. This is completely about things. And I've given you a broader range of songs. If anything resonates, or you even want to reply to this email, that would be great. And I happened to catch her on her honeymoon by the pool, and she had relaxed and she saw all this music coming through, because I actually attached the music first, and she saw this music coming through. So, well, there's new music to listen to, and I actually had said in the email, I want to do it, but I don't want to do the same as we did the first time. This has to be tied to connection. The connection happened accidentally and serendipitously the first time, but this time I know what we've done, and I know what I don't want to do part two. I want to do something that is all the time thinking about its impact on people. And it's about creating something real, something resonated, but something that is, that works fundamentally as music. I don't believe, I understand the need for charity albums. This isn't a charity album. It's an album which is meant to connect people. And alongside that, we'll raise money.
I like that. Right? I'm going to ask you something about that in a second. Give me your last song first, Michael.
Okay. The last song I picked, because it's so personal to me, is a song called When the Thought of You Catches Up With Me. And it was originally, and I never heard, at the stage we recorded it, I never heard the original. It was originally recorded as a country love song by a songwriter called David Ball. But I heard it through the singing of a singer from the US called Jimmy LeFave. And I only saw him singing it on the video, a live performance. But he was an amazing singer who never opened his eyes when he sang. And the reason was because and people said, well, you know, do you see the notes? And he said, no, I see colors. And he said, that's what I sing. I sing colors. So his performance is very, and he slowed the song down and went into it. When my son died in 2013, he was 21, and I heard this song and it just absolutely captured for me how grief catches up with you. When the thought of you catches up, you know, sometime it'll find me when I'm in bed, when I'm fast asleep, or I'll be driving down a lonesome highway. We used road in the song because it was a Donegal singer, and him singing highway just wouldn't be right. He wanted it had to be a lonesome road, and you come into view, and it just absolutely captures for me how the memory of somebody you love, you know, you put it away for a while, you think you put it away, and then without you realizing it, they're there, they're fully there, and they're absolutely there, and they're all you can see. And what was lovely is that I had heard Brian had organized a weekend down in Kilkee a few years ago where three bands played, and I hadn't been to a festival in years, and I said, there are three young bands that I've heard one or two songs, and why don't I can organize my own festival, because the three of them are going to play three successive nights. All I have to do is get myself to Kilkee, go along the three nights, and it'd be like, I used to go to the Listunvarna festival in the early 80s. And I said, this will be, you know, Kilkee, Listunvarna, close enough for jazz. And I'll go and make my own little festival. So I went along, and Kevin Herron was playing guitar with Claire Sands' band. And we eventually, I commissioned Claire Sands to write a song on Direct Provision, which was called For Whom the Bell Tolls. She released that on her Basement Sessions album. Kevin was playing guitar in the band, but because it was a free gig, they had to do a couple of, you know, you have to do a couple of cover versions because people haven't come to see you necessarily. And so Kevin did one vocal, and I remember hearing it and saying he could sing that song, but I wasn't going to record an album at that stage. And Kevin normally doesn't do vocals in his own band, Rowan. And I'd got Rowan to come on and do a couple of songs on it. And I said to their band leader, Dylan, I said, would you mind if I ask Kevin to do a song? And he said, Kevin, he'd be shy about doing a song. I said, but I have these couple of songs that really it's his voice would do it. And it would turn them from being American songs into Irish, you know, it would make more of a connection. And so I approached Kevin, and Kevin said, are you sure? And so he picked out his songs, and he picked out the one, I gave him a bigger range, but he picked out the ones that I already had. And we went down to the studios, and it was absolutely magical, because Dylan, who was the normal lead, played bass in it and piano. His mum had died shortly before the project started, and there was a lovely comment from musicians to a non-musician, as they said, we didn't realize, and we played it in the studio, how much space there was in the songs for the musicians. And that's my, you know, that I'm a Grateful Dead fan. I love Freeform, and I always remember Peter Green of Fleetwood Mac saying that he talks about his music, my favorite moment, he said, was playing with Grateful Dead, because there was so much space for me, right? And I was thinking, I've created space without even realizing it. They did an absolutely wonderful job on it. And we had a videographer who worked on producing videos for a lot of the songs. And for this song, she said, I can't do a professional video for it, because it's about your son. And I said, yeah, well, I said, it'll be a bit cheesy if we, you know, I've got these home videos. And she said, okay, just pull them all, get them all together and give me a lot, right? And it's then I learned about that the art of editing is different than the art of directing. And she created a video, and you would have sworn that back in 1998, when my son was six, that we filmed to the song. Right. When in fact, what it is that a good editor makes a film, and she did it. You know, it was just like so. It's provided so much solace to anybody who's heard it, because it's a universe. We all face loss, you know, and we face it at different times and in different ways, and we undermine our own sense of loss, you know, you know. And then, I remember going to a session with a bunch of people they were all men, and some people, their partner 50 years had died. Some people, their mother or their father had died. And I was the only one whose child had died. He was 21, but still your child. And they all insisted that it was worse for me. And I was saying, look, you know, love is love, loss is loss. And I said, if we have two separate road accidents, and I break my wrist, and you break both legs, right? Is my wrist any less sore as a result of your car crash? I said, your pain is your pain. It's 100% your pain. My pain is mine. It's 100% my pain. There is no hierarchy. And I think people try and put a hierarchy. So, like, I mean, we face disappointment. People face disappointment in work. People face disappointment. People feel they lose, you know, they don't get what they ordered in life, you know. And that's, you need to grieve for that as well, you know, because until you grieve, you can't heal. You know, and what this song did for me when I heard the original, was like when I heard my original of it, was it connected me to the grief and connected me to the love that underlay the grief. And, you know, Kevin, I won't do a Donegal accent. I can barely do a Cork accent. Kevin, the singer, I said to him, I said, look, you know, I won't give you the background to it. He said, I don't need any background. We've all got someone that it applies to. And I think that's the beauty of a really great song and a really great performance, is that it is, you're not presented with a package. It's there, and it gives enough room for somebody to find themselves in it and connect to it. But also, in connecting, the fact that you've connected to what somebody else is saying means you're not on your own.
It can happen any moment. For a reason or a right. It might be around the corner. It'll come up from behind. A picture that I thought would fade.
First of all, I'm sorry to hear about your son, and yeah, 21 years old, and
you'd have enjoyed him. He for the last two of years of his life, he was a stand-up comedian. And he to the day he died, he would claim that he tweeted Pope Benedict out of his job. Pope Benedict started tweeting, you know, he decided to be part of the modern world. Sorry, he started tweeting. So Arua sent him back a tweet which said, I have an urgent matter of faith which I need to discuss with you. He said, I'm on the Atkins diet. Is the host carbohydrate or is it protein? I need to know. he wasn't around that long, but he was certainly around.
That's wonderful to hear. And look, Mike, if what you do, there's so much synchronicity in the stuff you do, and I'm doing it a different way, but there's obviously our beliefs are fairly close in terms of connecting people for the right reason and creating that better world for all of us, you know, and whether it's through grief and connections or music or podcasts, whatever that is, you know, yeah. I'm trying to do my little bit, and obviously you're doing your much bigger bit, but I'm quite curious about what you're doing.
I don't know. I've been listening to your podcast and, I was listening, you know, I listened originally to prepare myself, and then I kept listening, and I was listening to one of them from a few weeks ago about the guy hitchhiking around Ireland and home. Yeah. And, you know, it's the same thing. It's the same. These stories need to be told.
Yeah. And I don't know you, I didn't know you, but your story is compelling and it interests me. And what interests me as well is the fact that you have a business and wealthy, healthy, it doesn't make any difference to me. You have a business, you're making a decision to allocate a certain amount of your time, your money, your energy to that wonderful idea of community. Which even this project you're doing by including artists, so there's a couple of layers there. One is for the charity, one is for the connection, one is for the non-working. I don't know Claire Sands personally, but I know of her work, and she's fantastic. So you're creating all these different layers of connection through each person has their own method. And, you know, Claire is a fantastic musician, Brian is perhaps an amazing organizer of gigs, you know, and all of that. And I love that. But it was that always with you, or is that something quite recent? Or you've always done that?
No. It was something that I've always tried to do, but I've got much better clarity on it.
Okay.
And I think it goes back to, I'd say two defining moments way back. I was living in England when Margaret Thatcher said that there's no such thing as society, right? Now, whatever about economics, whatever about methodologies, right? You can't always prove a statement to be true or false, right? But when you hear something which you know is fundamentally at odds with how you see the world, it's there. And I always remember saying, okay, I disagree, and if I disagree, right, why do I disagree and what do I do about it? Right. And that would bring me back to another defining moment. Back in the mid-70s when I was 15, before there was Garda vetting, because I happened to be 15 and 6'1", it was deemed it was okay for me to help out and mind children from really deprived backgrounds where they were brought away for a week's holiday. And I was privately educated, privileged, and I was there with, and I did that for three or four years. And so I saw a cohort of kids grow between 7 and 11, because that was the ages that they would be in that system, right? And they were the same mix of personalities as any other group, right? The only thing that was different for them was that they were poor. That was the only difference between them and me at 7 and any of my friends at 7. And that was the only difference between at 11, between what I had been like, because I was young enough that I could remember being 11. Mm. Right. I shouldn't have been there. But for me, it gave me an insight, which I've kept. And yet, we knew from stats at the time that 60% of them would have been in trouble with the law within 2 years of us, of that small window we had in their lives. Right. Now, if my cohort of people had got into trouble with the law, right, the Probation Act would have applied, because they came from good families, right? That there was nothing inherent in that group of people that meant that they should be the thing. And I just basically said, okay, the odds are stacked in my favor. And if the game is stacked in your favor, you can either say great or recognize the truth of that. And when you're approaching things, try and redress the balance. You can't, you won't necessarily rebalance it, right? But you should at least try, you know? And I've been fortunate in an awful lot of my life. I've been fortunate economically, but the biggest, you know, I'm an actuary, so I understand causality. Okay. The biggest influence on how you end up financially is how you start. That's the, you know, forget all the other things about ambition and drive and everything. Okay. It's the rules of the game, and the reality of the situation is, if you start well off, you're more likely to end up well off than if you don't, right? There are little outliers and stuff like that, but basically there isn't the mobility that people would like to remain in blissful ignorance and pretend it is, right? And I've hit hard times through mental illness. I've hit hard times through, you know, divorce, through, you know, through loss, and stuff like that. But I gave a talk on mental health a few years ago, and it was kind of, you know, I was trying to point out that if you dealt with mental health challenges, if you dealt with hardship, right, you're not a survivor, because you're still dealing with it, right? So survival links back to the perpetrator, you know, you know, like a survivor of a concentration camp. No, they were a person who shouldn't have been in a concentration camp. Mm-hmm. They were a human being, right? Okay, they did get through that experience, but they're a human being first, right? And don't take that away from them by necessarily just applying that. So I gave this talk, and I articulated, you know, how doing positive things was helping me heal, but it was still a challenge and everything like that. And I got to the end of it, and again, the ego kicked in because, you know, there was applause and people saying, oh, that was a very good presentation. And I said, that's great. Haven't I done well? And I said, any questions? And this guy came on and said, that was excellent. And I said, yeah. And he said, you're very well able to articulate what it's like to face challenges. And I said, thanks. And, you know, the ego was building again. And he said, so you have to do more of it. And I was thinking to myself, this is a question. That wasn't a question. Mm-hmm. So I said, oh, thanks, but I don't think that was a question. He said, my question is, are you going to do more of it? Because you should. Now, the bit for me was, he had me with his logic, because my thing is, if you're blessed with a gift, be it however small, be it to articulate, if you're able to articulate something that other people can't articulate, right, or aren't willing, aren't in a position to articulate, then I see you have a responsibility to do it. And I suppose from then on, from that bit, I said yes to him publicly. And I'm kind of someone who says, if I'm going to do something, then I'm going to do it. So I think from that bit on, I said, you know, because I've talked to loads of, I've known, I had a breakdown back in 1992, and I knew, a bunch of people who I met in hospital at the time and met in help groups afterwards. And very few of the people who had a severe breakdown got back, managed to get, people don't realize it's easy to fall off the rails. It's very hard to come back. And, but I remember going to meetings and seeing people who could not articulate their pain. Now, I can talk, whether I can articulate is another matter, but I can talk. And if you can, and if you have insight and you have the ability to give a voice and articulate what people might be going through, I don't see you have any choice but to do it, because you've only got one life to live. And I wrote a piece about loss, and just I threw it on LinkedIn. I like putting things into the wrong form, if you like, infecting business with a bit of kindness, you know, sort of making kindness a little bit viral. I put up a piece about loss, and I got a reply. I got a private message from somebody who I had done consulting with that company, and who I had met two or three times and just chatted to them briefly. But we were connected on LinkedIn, because it's good to have a lot of connections on LinkedIn. That's the way it's measured. He wrote to me and said, thank you. You know, it wasn't sent out for him. And he said, thank you so much for putting that. I don't have the courage yet to even respond and like your post. But he said, I've printed it off, and I'm going to read it again and again. And then sometime I'll feel strong enough to like that. Right? Now, if you can have that effect, right? And I know that I'm on this planet because some people were kind to me. They didn't know they made a difference. If you can have that effect, then I think you just have to keep doing it.
And that's great. You have you know your currency, and you're not afraid to spend it, which is great. It's great. Yeah. It's the way it should be. And so just before I let you go, I always ask everybody to give me an idea of a recommendation of a book, any book, anything at all that you... Once is not an annual that I did.
No. Okay. Can I recommend two?
You can recommend as many as you like. Two is fine.
Okay. I would recommend anything by Richard Brautigan. He was a beat poet. He was a beat poet, famous for trout fishing in America. But he had a beautiful description in a book called The Abortion, Historical Romance, where he is describing his chapters tend to be quite short because he's a poet who writes novels, and over seven chapters he's undressing this girl, but he's very conscious that she is terribly beautiful and sad. So he is trying to undress her without upsetting her by seeing her beauty. And he has a line in it where he just said that she said something about being happy. And he said, she said the word happy as if it was something that she'd only seen through a telescope. She'd only observed truth. And she had a Galilean connection with happiness. And right now, he is capable of that type of line all through his work. And it just there. So he is somebody where it seems very simple, but you read it and you just go, yes. You know? What I would recommend is read all his books, and which are, some of them are quite surreal, and then read So the Wind Won't Blow It All Away, where he actually takes all the ideas that are running through the other novels and not quite Kurt Vonnegut way, but similar. He just allows you to, this time he writes the story without the frills. And it for somebody who is read all his books, you realize that all the illusions that he's done, and all the little bits of verbal magic, they're all telling people have only one story to tell. And he, in that book, he was no longer popular. In fact, I couldn't even get it in paperback when it came out. And he killed himself shortly after. But in that book, he writes the story he was always writing, and he's given you all the clues along the way, and it's just breathtaking. But the other book, the book I would say that in sort of just blew me away was, we were having a conversation like this, having done the first album, I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, and she said, there's this book. She said, from all you're talking about, from all you're saying, there's this book you have to read. And I'll bring it the next time, you know. And it's one of those things you always say that'll happen. And the next time we met, which is always random, she was there, and she went into her coat and said, here it is. And it was a book called Flotsam by Eric Maria Remarque. And it was, we'd just done the piece with Claire Sands. We had commissioned the work on For Whom the Bell Tolls, and which was about the Irish direct provision system and the unfairness that's built into our entire business model and societal model. And she turned us into Gordon, and we were discussing that, and she said, here's the book. I just commissioned it, right? And I'd agreed to commission, and then I was given this book, and Claire said, look, we have to meet and discuss it. And so I was given this book, and she said, just read this book. And it was in the old, it was, you know, sometimes you can't judge a book by the cover. This was a really yellow papered book with a really bad romance noir cover, right? And it has nothing to do with the book in the inside. And it, basically, Flotsam refers to a bunch of stateless people in the mid-30s who are having to move from country to country, from Austria to Czechoslovakia overnight because they've had their papers taken away from them in Germany. And if you don't have papers, you don't exist. And so they're just flotsam, you know, that, you know, they're just floating, right? And, but I read the book and it was, it is beautifully written because what matters is that you care about the people, right? The politics is, the real politics of it is this should not happen to people. But a beautifully written book, a beautifully written novel, you care about that person. It's not I don't think this should happen to Syrians, mm-hmm. right? I don't think it's this shouldn't happen to this person. If it shouldn't happen to this person, then it shouldn't happen, right? So if you get it at the human level, if you get it at the absolutely human level where you're saying, how could this happen to anybody? And I was sitting there reading this book about to have the meeting with, going to have a meeting with Claire to try and convince her. And I had worked with Martin Leahy, a producer for the first album, and Martin and I speak the same musical language. So that, you know, I wanted to go, you know, a little bit of this feel and a little bit of that feel, but I hadn't had any long discussion with, I had had one long discussion with Claire, but it was about something else. And I said, how am I going to get it? And I said, so I brought her the book and I said, write a song that comes out of reading this book. Right. And, but it is beautiful because what was amazing was that it was written and published in 1937. Okay. You get a lot of books that are set in 1937 that were written in 1948. Okay. So this isn't somebody saying this terrible thing is about to happen. This was Eric Maria Remarque, who deliberately changed his name to a French sounding pronunciation just to annoy who fought in the First World War, you know, and was German, right? But he changed his name to the French sounding one because he knew it would annoy the Nazis, right? And he wrote this book in 1937, right? And it captures the fact that borders don't matter. There's no borders between people. Right. And we create these artificial passport. We create this artificial border and this delineation. And I come back to when I read that, it came back to a story that I used to always tell jokingly, but is absolutely, it is true. And I always say, remember the Slovenian woman, and which is, there was this woman who was born on a farm. And was born on the farm, grew up on the farm, was literally born, you know, at home in the early parts of the 20th century, grew up on the farm. And when Slovenia became an independent state, she had never left her own village. She lived in the same house, but 8 different flags had flown over it, right? So if anybody tells me that they are this nationality, that nationality, right, I'm saying we're all the Slovenian woman. Somebody else decides what flag is it waves over us, and what we have to do is realize we are humans. That's the nationality we belong to. And you might want to cheer on a football team. That's football, right? Is you've got to look after your family, and your family is everybody you meet. And the humanity in this writing, because he could have filled it with anger. Mm. He could have filled it with being, you know, this great polemic of, you know, it could have been the Marxist dialectic versus the thing. Nothing about this. It was just, this is what happens to people when they become stateless, when they don't have papers. They're just treated as flotsam of life. And and if you recognize the people are being treated then that way, then, you know, maybe it'd be not, if, you know, there's little incidents of kindness which are not nationality based either, right? And which, you know, are life saving in these cases, but they're also life enhancing, even if they're not life saving. Mm-hmm. And it's just that, it's probably the most human work I've on a difficult subject, most human work I've done, because it's a work of, because it's a work of fiction grounded in truth, right? It allows you to really feel it. You don't get into politics. You don't get into things. You just have a thing is your heart breaks for people, right? Your heart breaks for people and you will them to succeed. And every time I see somebody say, it's back to the Victorian idea of the deserving poor. There's the deserving migrant and the undeserving migrant. Okay. Anybody who goes through hell to get here, right? The bit to remember is they've been through hell.
Yeah.
Right. And if you have any feeling, there's nobody you should want to be living in hell. Life is hard enough without putting anybody in there. It's a marvelous book.
Wonderful.
I don't do short winded. I apologize.
That's quite all right. That, it's an absolutely fascinating conversation, and I'm absolutely delighted that you took the time to talk to me. And we could talk for a lot longer, but I think I'll leave it at that, Michael Fitzgerald.
Okay. Thank you very much. And thank you. And keep connecting people. I think it's brilliant.
Thank you.
Hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Fitzgerald. Please subscribe, share and review. Really is appreciated. Check out his project, Sunrise, Sunfold on YouTube. And I'm going to leave you with one more song from their album. Hannah Mitchell singing The Rain Came Down on Everything.
My heart was reaching to your shore.